Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today takes us back to a cold January morning in the coal fields of southern West Virginia. At first glance, it looks like a story about labor dispute, union miners standing shoulder to shoulder on a picket line, non-union workers simply trying to make it to work, law enforcement doing everything they could to keep the peace. But within minutes, that picket line would become a crime scene. Gunfire would echo through North Fork Holler. One man would lose his life, two others would be seriously wounded. And despite one of the largest investigations to come out of the incident, the person responsible for the fatal shot has never been identified. More than three decades later, questions still remain about what really happened that morning, who fired first, and who killed John McCoy. This is the case of the McDowell County Picket Line Murder. By January of 1990, tensions in McDowell County had already been building for months. Coal miners were no strangers to disagreements with management. That had been happening in southern West Virginia for generations. But this dispute was different. This wasn't simply about wages or working conditions. It centered around something many miners considered just as important. Promises. Promises they believed had been broken.
And before we get into the shooting itself, I think we should explain why these miners were even standing on that road that morning, because this wasn't just a random protest.
Exactly. The men gathered that morning were members of the United Mine Workers of America, better known as the UMWA. For months, they've been protesting Bailey Energy, a non-union mining operation in North Fork Holler. According to reports at the time, one of the major issues involved unpaid medical benefits. Union leaders claimed Regency Industries owed approximately $375,000 in medical bills to workers. The union's position was simple. Until those obligations were paid, mining operations would stop.
So this wasn't something that happened overnight. This had been going on for months.
It had. Danny Surface, who served as an international board member at the UMWA, later explained that union members had spent nearly 6 months protesting. According to him, United Pocahontas Corporation had previously owned nine mines in McDowell County before selling them to Regency Industries. Three of those mines remained union-operated. Six became non-union. Surface said union miners hoped every one of those operations would shut down until Regency paid what workers believed they were owed. Most eventually did, but two mines continued operating. But two mines continued operating, Bailey Energy and HC Industries. Those two mines became the center of the protest. Every morning, union miners gathered along the road leading into Bailey Energy. Their goal was simple, convince non-union miners not to cross the picket line.
So had things gone violent before this?
There's certainly been tension, arguments, yelling, name-calling. But according to many of the people who were actually there, nothing like what was about to happen. Former West Virginia State Police Trooper Steve Cox was assigned to monitor the picket line that morning. Years later, he reflected on just how ordinary everything initially seemed. He said, quote, "I've been on several picket lines just to keep law and order and never had this happen before," end quote. He described the atmosphere as tense. but not out of control. There was some arguing, some shouting, but nothing that suggested anyone would be dead before the morning was over.
And that's coming from the trooper standing right in the middle of it.
Looking back now, it's easy to assume everyone woke up expecting violence. But that's not how the people there described it to them. It was another morning on the picket line, another day trying to make their voices heard. Then, January 16th arrived. It was cold, just after 8:30 that morning. Three vehicles carrying non-union miners approached the entrance to Bailey Energy, and as the first truck passed those picketers, rocks flew, windows shattered. The second vehicle wasn't spared either, with more windows broken. Trooper Cox later admitted that so many people gathered there, there was simply too much confusion to tell who had thrown anything. After speaking briefly with those drivers, the vehicles continued towards the mine. Then Cox turned his attention back to the picketers. He later recalled that they weren't threatening him. In fact, he described them as friendly. There was no indication that that morning was about to spiral completely out of control.
So at this point, from his perspective, this was just another difficult day on the picket line.
Exactly. And then the third vehicle arrived, just like the first two. The truck never simply passed through, though, because within seconds, everything changed. When we come back, a state trooper mistakes gunfire for firecrackers. A truck stops in the middle of the road, armed men scramble for cover, and before the smoke clears, one union miner is dead.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe
and watch for deer.
When we left off, the first two vehicles carrying non-union miners had already made their way through the picket line. Both had been struck by rocks, windows had been shattered. Trooper Steve Cox had spoken with the drivers before they continued towards the mine. Then he turned back towards the picketers. By his own account, things had settled down, people were talking, there wasn't any obvious aggression. And for a brief moment, it looked like the morning was going to continue the same way countless others had before it. Then the third vehicle came around the bend.
And this is really where everything changes.
It is. According to retired West Virginia State Police Trooper B.J. Garrison, who later became the lead investigator before State Police's 2011 cold case investigation, this third truck was also carrying non-union miners headed to work at Bailey Energy. As it approached the picket line, shots suddenly ran out. Not one, not two, multiple shots. Garrison said investigators later determined the truck had been struck by at least a couple of bullets. One of those rounds hit the truck's rear quarter panel.
Mark, what's interesting here is that Trooper Cox didn't immediately realize what he was hearing.
He didn't. Standing there in the middle of all the confusion, he later recalled hearing what he thought was firecrackers. In fact, he remembered yelling, quote, "What are you doing throwing firecrackers?" End quote. It wasn't until moments later that everyone realized those weren't firecrackers. Those were gunshots.
Which really tells you how unexpected this was. Even the trooper on the scene didn't immediately think someone had opened fire.
Exactly. And before anyone had time to process what was happening, the truck stopped. According to investigators, the driver and one of the passengers jumped out. Both men were armed. They immediately took cover behind the truck. Then they fired back. Now, this next part is important. According to Garrison, the original investigative reports never concluded whether those two men were aiming at a specific individual. firing into the wooded hills, or simply returning fire in the general direction the shots had came from. That distinction matters, because decades later, investigators still don't know which shot ultimately killed John McCoy.
So now you've got gunfire coming from more than one direction.
Exactly. That's what made the scene so incredibly difficult to investigate. Once the return fire started, the situation completely unraveled. Gerritsen said, after the first shots were returned, several more gunshots echoed through North Fork Holler. Some, according to the reports, appear to come from the wooded hillside. Others came from workers near the truck. The exchange lasted somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes. Now, 5 minutes may not seem like a long time, but imagine standing on a narrow road in a mountain holler. Gunfire echoing off the hillsides, people running for cover, no one knowing exactly where the shots are coming from. 5 minutes could have felt like an eternity.
And at this point, Trooper Cox is the only law enforcement there.
He is. One trooper, dozens of people, multiple firearms, no backup. Cox immediately radioed for assistance, but while help was on the way, he was left trying to prevent the situation from becoming even worse. At one point, he later recalled hearing people say they were going to storm the mine. So he made a split-second decision. He pulled his cruiser across the roadway, blocking everyone from driving farther into the mine property.
Honestly, that may have prevented this from turning into something even bigger.
It very well could have, because at that point, nobody knew how many people were shooting. Nobody knew if more people had been hit. Nobody knew if the violence was over, or just beginning. Eventually, the gunfire stopped. Silence settled over North Fork Holler, but the danger hadn't passed. Trooper Cox began moving carefully through the area, talking to people, trying to understand what just happened. About 30 minutes later, he found John McCoy. The 42-year-old union miner from Welch had suffered gunshot wounds to his neck and chest. He died there. Two other picketers had also been shot. Steve Morgan, who had been struck in the right thigh. Daryl Morgan suffered gunshot wounds to the abdomen and one of his hands. Thankfully, both men survived, but John McCoy didn't.
It's heartbreaking because just a few minutes earlier, this was another morning on a picket line. Now someone is dead.
Exactly, and that's what shocked so many people. The violence wasn't just unexpected, it was unprecedented. Former trooper Steve Cox later reflected on that morning and said that in all of the picket lines he worked, he never experienced anything like it. And that's saying something, because labor disputes in southern West Virginia weren't new. But this was different. The shooting of John McCoy instantly became more than a local homicide investigation. It was national news. Questions immediately began swirling. Who fired first? Who fired the shot that killed John McCoy? Was the fatal bullet fired by one of the non-union workers? Did it come from someone hiding in the woods? Could it have came from another picketer? At that point, no one knew. And unfortunately, those questions have never fully been answered. When we come back, investigators seize 17 firearms. Every weapon is sent to the West Virginia State Police Crime Lab. Ballistics experts began comparing bullets and shell casings. But despite one of the largest evidence collections from a crime scene like this, the murder weapon was never identified.
And once rumors start spreading about what happened that morning, the investigation becomes even more complicated.
Hey everyone, I'm Alex, and I'm from APAW Unsolved in West Virginia. I'm a missing persons advocate with a background in criminal justice and psychology, and this channel was created to bring attention to the missing and murdered cases that deserve to be remembered. Here we talk about real people, real families, real stories that still need answers. I spend time researching these cases, speaking with families, and sharing the stories of victims from West Virginia and surrounding areas in hopes of bringing more awareness to cases that are often forgotten. Some of these families have spent years searching for answers. Some are still waiting for someone to come forward, and sometimes all it takes is one person hearing a story to make a difference. If you care about true crime, advocacy, and helping keep these cases in the public eye, make sure to subscribe to APAL Unsolved in West Virginia on YouTube and follow me on Facebook. Together, we can help make sure these stories are never forgotten.
By the time the gunfire stopped, North Fork Holler looked nothing like it had just a few minutes earlier. The shouting had stopped. The truck sat riddled with damage. One man was dead, two others were wounded. And law enforcement was now faced with a crime scene unlike anything they had ever dealt with before. Because this wasn't just a shooting involving people. It wasn't just a handful of people. This involved dozens of individuals, multiple firearms, and gunshots coming from different directions.
And I think that's what makes this investigation so difficult right from the beginning. It's not as simple as saying, quote, who had the gun, end quote, because a lot of people had guns.
Exactly. Retired West Virginia State Police First Sergeant J.R. Pauley was stationed at the Welch Department when the strike was taking place. Years later, he reflected on just how chaotic the scene really was. According to Pauley, investigators quickly realized that people on both sides of the dispute were armed. Union picketers had guns, non-union workers had guns, and now they had to determine who fired what shots. He described the scene as incredibly difficult. There wasn't some neat list of everyone involved. There wasn't one obvious suspect. Instead, there was a crowd of people, many of them carrying firearms, and one state trooper trying to reign control of the situation.
It's almost impossible to picture one trooper trying to sort through all of that.
It really is. Pauley later said, quote, there's no list of players beforehand. You have several people, a crowd of people, and then one trooper there by himself trying to confiscate all of the weapons, end quote. Imagine trying to preserve a crime scene under those conditions. People are emotional, some are angry, others are scared. Nobody fully understands what just happened. And investigators know that every passing minute increases the chances of evidence being lost. So one of the first priorities became collecting every firearm they could. As investigators worked the scene, weapons were seized from both the non-union workers and the picketers. In total, 17 firearms were collected.
17? That's incredible.
It is, and every single one of those weapons was sent to the West Virginia State Police Crime Laboratory. Investigators weren't taking shortcuts. They wanted answers. Ballistic experts began examining every firearm, every shell casing, every recovered bullet, every piece of physical evidence they could find. Their goal was straightforward. Figure out which weapon fired the bullet that killed John McCoy.
And you would think with 17 guns, modern forensic testing would eventually narrow it down.
That's exactly what investigators hoped. But that's not what happened. Despite intensive testing, no firearm could be matched to the bullet that killed him. Think about that for a second. 17 guns, every one of them tested, and still, no murder weapon.
That had to be incredibly frustrating, because without that match, you're missing one of the biggest pieces of evidence in the entire case.
Exactly. Instead of answering questions, the forensic evidence created even more. Almost immediately after the shooting, rumors began spreading through McDowell County. Some people believed the fatal shot had came from one of the non-union workers. Others insisted that wasn't possible. Then another theory started circulating. What if the fatal shot came from somewhere else entirely? Trooper B.J. Gerritsen said, There had long been rumors that additional picketers had positioned themselves in the wooded hills overlooking the road. If that was true, it meant shots may have been coming from places investigators couldn't immediately account for.
Which suddenly changes the entire investigation, because now you're not just looking at the people standing beside the road, you're potentially looking into the woods too.
Exactly. And remember, witnesses had already described hearing gunfire from multiple directions. Some believe shots were fired from the roadway. Others believe they came from higher up in the hillside. The terrain of North Fork Holler only complicated matters. Steep hills, dense woods, echoes bouncing through the valley. Trying to determine exactly where a shot originated would have been incredibly difficult, especially in 1990. Then investigators uncovered something else. Another theory that had nothing to do with the labor dispute itself. Garrettson later revealed that John McCoy had reportedly been under investigation by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives at the time of his death. According to the investigative reports, it involved allegations surrounding explosives, specifically the possible sale or transportation of dynamite.
Now that's interesting, because that immediately makes you want to wonder. Was this really connected to the strike, or was something else going on?
Exactly. And to be clear, investigators never publicly concluded that the AFT investigation had anything to do with John's murder. But because it existed, it became another avenue they had to consider. Was the shooting entirely related to the picket line? Or did someone use the chaos that morning to settle an entirely different score? Those are two very different possibilities, and unfortunately, neither one could never be proven. Despite the rumors, investigators never stopped working the case. Polly later described the original investigation as extremely thorough. He said investigators stayed on top of it for days. Additional troopers were brought in to McDowell County to assist. Witnesses were interviewed, evidence was processed, every lead was followed. This wasn't just a case where law enforcement simply gave up. They worked it hard.
But sometimes even doing everything right isn't enough.
Exactly, because without the murder weapon, without a defiant ballistic match, and without someone coming forward with first-hand knowledge, the investigation eventually reached a standstill. The case remained open, but the answers investigators desperately wanted never came. At least, not then. When we come back, we step back and look at why tensions had reached such a breaking point in southern West Virginia. While longtime miners say this strike felt different than those before it, and how John McCoy's funeral became a powerful show of solidarity for the United Mine Workers of America.
Because while investigators searched for a killer, an entire community was mourning one of its own.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're
Country Roads Creeps.
We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
When we left off, investigators had collected 17 firearms. Every weapon had been sent to the West Virginia State Police Crime Laboratory. Witnesses had been interviewed. Evidence has been processed. And despite all of that, investigators still couldn't identify the weapon that killed John McCoy. The case had stalled. But while law enforcement searched for answers, the community was preparing for something else. A funeral. And if there was ever any doubt about how deeply this tragedy affected Southern West Virginia, that doubt disappeared on January 19, 1990. Hundreds of members of the United Mine Workers of America gathered to pay their respects. Many arrived dressed in camouflage. Not because they were making a statement of intimidation, because they wanted to stand together, to show solidarity with one of their own.
That had to be an incredibly emotional scene, because this wasn't just another funeral, this was a community grieving together.
Exactly. John McCoy wasn't simply remembered as the man who was killed on the picket line. He was remembered as a husband, a father, a fellow miner, a union brother. For many of the people who attended that funeral, his death represented something much bigger than one tragic morning. District 28 spokesman Gene Carroll didn't mince words when speaking to reporters. He described the shooting as, quote, a cold-blooded murder, end quote. Just days after the funeral, Carroll told the Daily Telegraph, quote, it's a great tragedy. The fact is, the man had a couple of children and a family he cared about. It was murder, nothing but cold-blooded murder, end quote. He didn't stop there. He continued, quote, it's a terrible thing. It's a sad day for all of us. If the resolution to bloodshed is with more bloodshed, then there is no solution, end quote.
And I think that last statement says everything, because no matter which side of the labor dispute someone was on, nobody wanted this.
Exactly. People expected heated arguments. They expected protests. They expected tempers to flare, but very few expected someone to lose their life. In fact, many people who had spent decades around labor disputes said this shooting was unlike anything they had ever experienced. Jack Wells, who served as captain of plant protection in Gary, reflected on that history. He told the Daily Telegraph that there had certainly been shootings at labor unrest in years past, but nothing like this. He remembered violence dating back to the early 1940s when U.S. Steel first signed an agreement with the United Mine Workers, but he said he's never seen anything quite as serious as what happened on January 16, 1990.
It's really saying something, because Southern West Virginia has a long history of labor disputes.
It does. Coal mining and organized labor have always been deeply connected throughout Appalachia. And unfortunately, that history included conflict. But even people who had lived through early labor struggles were stunned by what happened in North Fork Holler. Jimmy McNeely, who served as general counsel for the UMWA District 29, echoed those thoughts. He said labor disagreements certainly weren't uncommon, but shootings like this, those were. This wasn't how disputes were supposed to end. To really understand why emotions were running so high, you have to understand what miners believed they were fighting for. Former UMWA field director Buck Wade later reflected that period during interviews conducted years afterwards. He described the late 1980s and early 1990s as a turning point for organized labor in Southern West Virginia. According to Wade, new ownership and changing business practices were reshaping the coal industry. Union miners were becoming non-union. Jobs were disappearing. Communities that had depended on organized labor for generations suddenly found themselves facing an uncertain future. Many miners believed they weren't just fighting for a paycheck. They believed they were fighting for their families, for healthcare, for pensions. for the future of mining communities throughout southern West Virginia.
So when people hear picket line, they shouldn't picture protests lasting an hour or two. These men have been living this dispute every day for months.
Exactly. Every morning, they'd show up. Every morning, they'd stand along that road. Every morning, they hoped something would change. Unfortunately, on January 16th, 1990, everything changed. Just not in the way anyone wanted. As the weeks turned into months, and the months turned into years, no arrests were made. No murder weapon was identified. And the death of John McCoy slowly became one of West Virginia's unsolved homicide cases. But investigators never completely gave up. More than 20 years later, the West Virginia State Police launched a renewed effort to examine unsolved murders across the state. John McCoy's case was one of them. Retired trooper B.J. Gerritsen became the lead investigator during that cold case initiative. He reviewed the original reports, spoke with investigators who had worked on the case in 1990, looked over the evidence once again, and after everything he read, he reached the same conclusion many investigators had before him. Somebody knew what happened. When we come back, we'll talk about why investigators still believe this case can be solved, the plea they're making to the public more than three decades later, and why John McCoy's family is still waiting for answers.
Because sometimes time doesn't erase the truth, it just makes it harder to find.
Hey y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcast.
When you look back at the murder of John McCoy, one thing becomes painfully clear. This wasn't a case where investigators locked evidence. It wasn't a case where law enforcement simply walked away. From the very beginning, they threw everything they had at it. 17 firearms were collected. Ballistics were conducted. Witnesses were interviewed. Crime scene evidence was processed. Additional troopers were brought to assist. By every account, investigators worked with this case tirelessly.
But despite all of that, they couldn't answer the one question that mattered the most. Who fired the shot that killed John McCoy?
Exactly. And that's why more than three decades later, this case remains unsolved. One of the biggest obstacles investigators faced was the sheer number of people involved. This wasn't a shooting between two individuals. This happened in the middle of a labor dispute involving dozens of people. Some were union miners, some were non-union workers, others were simply there trying to keep the peace. When the shooting started, people scattered. Some took cover, some returned fire. Others ran. Trying to piece together exactly what happened during those chaotic minutes proved incredibly difficult.
And memories don't get better with time. They fade. People move away. Sometimes witnesses pass away. That only makes solving a case like this even harder.
It does. But despite the passage of time, investigators never given up completely. In 2011, the West Virginia State Police launched a renewed effort to revisit unsolved homicides from across the state. John McCoy's murder was one of those cases selected. Retired trooper B.J. Gerritsen took another look at everything. He reviewed investigative reports. He spoke with officers who had originally worked on the case. He examined the evidence all over again. And after doing all of that, he came away believing something investigators had suspected from the beginning. Somebody knew exactly what happened that morning. Gerritsen later said something that has always stuck with me. After reviewing the case and speaking with those involved, he said, quote, "Someone knows something about this. It's going to take them coming forward to put this to rest," end quote. Think about that. He's not saying investigators have exhausted every possibility. He's saying the missing piece has always been out there. It's been sitting with someone for decades. Maybe someone who witnessed something. Maybe someone who heard something afterward. Maybe someone who had carried the weight of that morning for 35 years.
And we've seen that happen before. Sometimes it's one conversation, one memory, and one person finally deciding they are ready to talk.
Exactly. Cold cases are solved every year because someone finally comes forward. Sometimes relationships change. Sometimes loyalties disappear. Sometimes people simply reach a point where they can't carry the secret anymore. Could that happen here? Absolutely. As I was researching this case, I kept thinking about something. It's easy to remember January 16, 1990 as the day gunfire erupted on a picket line. It's easy to remember the controversy, the labor dispute, the investigation, the rumors. But at the center of all of that was a man who never came home. John McCoy wasn't just another name in an unsolved homicide file. He was a husband, a father, a minor, a member of his community. Someone who believed strongly enough in what he was fighting for that he stood on that picket line that cold January morning. Whether you agree with the strike or not, whether you support unions or you don't, whether you believe the shooting happened one way or another, one fact remains. A man lost his life, and his family spent decades without the answers they deserve.
I think that's what stays with me after hearing this story. Not just that someone died, but that after all these years, no one has been held accountable.
Exactly. The history surrounding this case is important. The labor dispute is important. The investigation is important. But justice is important too. And until the person responsible for John McCoy's death is identified, the story isn't finished. It's simply waiting for the next chapter. If you have any information about the murder of John McCoy, no matter how small you think it may be, please contact the Welch Detachment of the West Virginia State Police at 304-436-2101. Even after all these years, one piece of information could finally bring answers to a family that has been waiting since 1990.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Mountain State Mysteries. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a review, and share this episode with someone who enjoys true crime and Appalachian history.
You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube by searching Mountain State Mysteries. Until next time,
stay safe.
And remember, sometimes history isn't found in old books. Sometimes it's waiting to be solved.